This episode was randomly selected from the set of all possible episodes.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the Beyond Podcast, the podcast that is also questing for the essence of mind and pattern. This is a podcast for anyone who is fairly sure that our universe supports intelligent life.
Hi, folks. Welcome back. My name is Vadim, and I'll be your host again. Welcome to the podcast that discusses meta concepts. In the past couple of episodes, we looked at meta topics in the science of physics and the science of big numbers, which some people call mathematics. Of course, as we discussed previously, such fun metaness in fields like mathematics, logic, and computer science comes perhaps more easily than in other branches of inquiry, such as natural sciences. I suppose it's easier to discover or invent so-called paradoxes and loopy self-referential ideas in the nested or stacked abstractions of various mathematical disciplines rather than in the real world. The real world ought to be devoid of paradoxes, and whenever something comes up in nature that seems like a contradiction, that means that our existing understanding of the phenomenon is incomplete and we must go deeper.
Nice try, but my head was built with paradox-absorbing crumple zones.
However, in this episode, I do want to return back to topics within maths, which is always a reliable source of fun, intuition-twisting puzzlers. And specifically, I want to look at the intersection of probability theory, statistics, epistemology, and weird thought experiments. How does that sound? When we first get an introduction to probability in school, curriculums often start with combinatorics and concepts that can be rooted in intuition. For example, we all have a pretty good practical understanding of coin tosses, dice rolls, and the spins of the roulette wheel. From there, we can build up an understanding of probabilities connected to repeated events and reason about outcomes sampled from many runs of some theoretical experiment. We can learn how to calculate the expected value and determine, for example, how much money one can expect to win, or most likely lose, while playing a specific casino game or a lottery.
Everything on 34!
But even though the initial introduction to probability often feels like common sense, you fairly quickly encounter ideas that may defy intuition and even seem paradoxical. Now, as we will discuss shortly, these ideas are rarely actual paradoxes. Instead, they are results that are simply counterintuitive, yet provably true. For example, you have probably heard of the so-called Monty Hall puzzle, which borrows its name from the original host of the American TV game show, Let's Make a Deal. The setup of this puzzle is simple. Imagine yourself as a contestant on a show where you are presented with three initially closed doors. There is a valuable prize behind one of the doors. You make an initial guess about which door leads to the prize. The game show host then opens another door, not the door you chose, but a door that definitely does not have the prize. Now you have a choice. You can either stick with the door that you originally chose, or you can switch your selection to the other unopened door. The Monty Hall problem is now well known because of its wide coverage in popular math and science videos. The result, which I will repeat now, is no longer considered controversial. But when this problem was first shared in a magazine article in 1950, the opinions of the readers were rather passionate and heated. I have included a link to the online version of this Parade magazine article in the transcript of this episode, available at thebeyondpod.com. So why the controversy? Well, the article suggested that it is always a better strategy to switch to the other door when given the chance. In fact, you have twice as good odds of winning a prize. And the argument to support this reasoning is simple. When you make your initial guess, you have a 1 in 3 chance of being right, which means that there is a 2 in 3 chance of you being wrong. When the game show host reveals a door that does not have the prize, you now have a situation where the 2/3 probability is transferred to the other unopened door, whereas your original choice still only has a 1 in 3 odds of being correct. You are doubling your odds by switching. So again, why the controversy? Well, for many people, intuition would dictate that there is no statistical reason to switch doors. After the host opens the door that does not have the prize, you find yourself with two closed doors, the one that you originally selected and the other one. Both may contain the prize, so surely the odds are equal. That is, both doors seemingly have a one-half probability of being correct, so switching offers no advantages. A great many responders to the magazine article, many of them mathematicians in academia, asserted this view. After some intense debate, the matter was settled. It is indeed better to switch to the other door. Let's imagine that someone you explain this problem to just refuses to accept the answer. Their intuition just screams that switching is irrational and the odds really are 50-50 between the two unopened doors. One way you might convince them is to run a few simulations. You can either write some code to reenact Monty Hall, or just do it with pen and paper. Over a sufficient number of iterations, it will be obvious that the switching strategy gives you twice better odds of winning. In the transcript of this episode, I included a tiny Python program that runs 10,000 simulations while tracking the overall stats of the two strategies. I find Monty Hall to be an interesting problem because it definitely challenges what initially seems like common sense. But, as I mentioned earlier, while this type of problem can be a head-scratcher, at the end of the day, there are no deeper implications here. The problem presents what's known as a veridical paradox, something that's provably true, but just counterintuitive. There are other puzzles in probability which also yield a seemingly obvious result at a first glance, but then you get bogged down in the specific statement of the problem. For example, the so-called boy or girl problem presents a seemingly innocently worded question about the probability of a family having two boys. I'm not going to dive too deep into this one, but ambiguity arises from the details we are presented about the children in this family and how this family is sampled from the set of all possible families.
Hey, kids, we're eating dinner tonight. Come on, Tiffany, Heather, Cody, Dylan, Dermot, Jordan, Taylor.
If I tell you that a family has two children and that the older one is a boy, it is not unreasonable to say, fine, the probability of the other child of being a boy is 50-50, just as it would be for any random birth. The information about the older child being a boy does not change anything. With this reasoning, you would arrive at the correct answer. But the reasoning, while intuitive, is not generally correct. Why not? Well, consider the version of this problem where you are told that a family has two children and that at least one of them is a boy. Now, what is the probability that there are two boys? If you follow the naive path, you might say that this is the same as the other version of the problem. Knowing that at least one child is a boy ought to have no bearing on the other child. Or does it? Well, let's consider the set of all possible families that meet our criteria. Without any clarifying information, we can assume that families with two children fall into one of four groups in terms of the older and younger child. There's girl-girl, girl-boy, boy-girl, and boy-boy. But we actually do have extra information. We know that the family has at least one boy. That means that we're only considering families that have a girl-boy, boy-girl, or boy-boy combinations of their two children. Now the question of what is the probability that there are two boys is applied to a different initial pool of families. In this filtered pool, only one-third of the families have two boys. Therefore, the answer is 1 in 3 and not 1 in 2. Just like in the Monty Hall case, any doubt about this can be addressed by just writing out the combinations and counting the results. At this point, you might say, okay, these probability puzzles are fun, but where's the meta-ness? So let's take a huge metaphysical step back. That's metaphysical, one word. You are hopefully enjoying this podcast while walking or driving or doing house chores, but more importantly, while existing in a universe that is capable of not only having matter and energy, but also stars, planets, biochemistry, life forms, and especially smart life forms like dolphins and mice. So if you run into a friend who is also pondering metaphysics, and your friend sort of looks around and gestures broadly and then says, what are the odds?
As long as there have been humans, we have searched for our place in the cosmos.
The odds of what, you might ask? Well, your friend could be asking about a number of things. Maybe they're wondering about the odds of intelligent life evolving. Maybe it's a question about complex life. Maybe it's a question about life itself. Or maybe it's about the universe as we know it, with all the physical laws and physical constants being what they are. Regardless of the scope, it's a tough question to even begin to consider, especially from a probabilistic point of view, because with probabilities, you're considering the likelihood of events against a backdrop of some repeated process. You think about possible outcomes. What if I roll two dice? What if a fair coin is flipped several times? What if I select a random family from a population of a certain size? These ideas we can wrap our minds around. But what does it mean to ask the same type of question about physical constants, given that we just have one universe accessible to us for study? When your friend contemplates nature and existence and asks, "What are the odds?" How do you even begin to approach such a question? And how does your thinking about this change if you consider the fact that in a universe that could not support intelligent life, there would be no curious observers to even ask such questions? We will try to get a feel for this type of anthropic reasoning by exploring the 2002 book Anthropic Bias: Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy by the philosopher Nick Bostrom. But before we even try to scratch at the surface of such deep questions, let's take a few steps forward into the realm of more mundane matters. You throw a net into a lake. Perhaps you're hungry, or maybe you're just curious about the sizes of the creatures that live there. So your plan is to measure whatever your net catches, and later you will throw everything back in the water. So you pull the net out, and sure enough, there are various fish there that you can observe and size up.
Whatever it is, it's 20 times heavier than a boot.
After repeating this process a few times and collecting the data about what you caught, what could you infer? For example, is the smallest fish that you've seen representative of how small a fish can be? What about the largest fish? Is this as big as they get? Certainly the data you've collected is useful to a study of sea creatures and their populations, but what are the limits of your data gathering methodology? What could you be missing? As you stare at your netting material, you realize that your net is basically a grid of intersecting lines that form squares that are 5 centimeters on the side. So any creature smaller than this will easily swim through your net without getting caught. On the flip side, any creature larger than your entire net will also be too big to be captured by this method. Also, you quickly realize that while you did collect your samples fairly evenly over the entire surface of the lake, the ropes tied to your net only let you submerge it so deep, so any creatures that live deeper than your net's reach would also be absent from your survey. Is measuring fish too boring? Okay, let's turn to more heavenly matters and start by looking up. Scientists have invented a netting of sorts to catch planets orbiting around stars. There are a few methods for this. For example, we can measure the wobble of a star as it orbits around a mutual center of gravity with a planet. We can also observe a slight but regular dip in the amount of light coming from a star when a planet or planets transit in front of it, as seen from solar system-based observatories. And as you probably already know, or guessed, based on the description of these methods, the planets that you're going to net this way are going to be the larger ones. Now, scientists have discovered several smaller exoplanets, small even as compared to the Earth. But for the most part, you're going to much more likely find the big Jupiter-sized planets. Also, you're more likely to find planets that orbit close to their star. If you want to generalize from this data, you have to apply rigorous statistical methods to compensate for the observational bias of your planet-finding methodology. The same considerations apply if you're doing any kind of observation of objects in space. You will, of course, tend to see the brightest objects in their class, and you will need to factor in this bias, known as the Malmquist bias, when analyzing your findings. So with these mundane and heavenly examples, we can start to get a sense of how observer-dependent effects can influence probability. And yet, I still feel like the fish and planet examples are still within the realm of intuition, provided that you take the time to think critically about the observational limits of how you catch those stars or fish, or if you're lucky, starfish. So let's steer this conversation back towards topics where intuition is challenged. Imagine that there is a container that's opaque and it has 10 balls in it, numbered 1 through 10. The identifying number is just written on the side of each ball. You're able to reach in without looking inside and pull a ball out at random and then look at the number. There is another container that contains a million balls, numbered 1 through 1 million. Let's pretend for the sake of this thought experiment that the two containers are the same size, and you cannot get a sense of how many balls there are inside by just reaching in and feeling your way around. You just put your hand in, pull out a single ball at random, and look at the number. With this setup in mind, you are presented with one of the two containers, so you reach in, pull out a ball, and that ball is numbered 7. You then have to guess which container you were given, the one with 10 balls or the one with a million. Obviously, if the number you pulled out were greater than 10, there would be no uncertainty about the source. But if the number is between 1 and 10, then the ball could have come from either container. It's just that it's overwhelmingly more likely that such a ball would be drawn from the container with containing only 10 balls than from the one with a million. So far, so good?
Or does that confuse you?
Now let's get a little bit existential. Let me offer you a quote. Behind every man alive stand 30 ghosts, for that is the ratio by which the dead outnumber the living. Since the dawn of time, roughly 100 billion human beings have walked the planet Earth. This is the opening line of the 1968 novel 2001 A Space Odyssey by Arthur C. Clarke. Clarke's reference to 100 billion human beings is still very close to modern estimates. However, the ratio of one living person to 30 ghosts no longer holds, and that is understandable. You see, in 1968, the world population was around 3.5 billion people, and today it's over 8 billion, so the current ratio is more like 1 to 14. But the numeric details do not change the poetry and awe of this opening line. If you haven't read 2001, A Space Odyssey, go do so right now. I will wait. Did you read it? Good. I will also wait while you go and watch the Stanley Kubrick film based on this novel. So let's say we go with these estimates and assign ourselves an approximate birth rank among all humans who have ever lived. If you were born at the beginning of the 21st century, you might be human number 103 billion. Somebody born after you would have a higher rank, and anyone older than you would have a lower rank. But for the sake of using nice round numbers, let's just treat the birth rank of anyone listening to this podcast to be approximately 100 billion. Now let us consider two hypotheses about the future of humanity. Hypothesis A states that when human civilization ends, there will have been 1 trillion humans who have ever lived. That is 10 times the 100 billion number that we're using as our own position in history. Hypothesis B, however, is more optimistic. It states that when humanity ends, there will have been 1 quadrillion humans. That is 1,000 times greater than hypothesis A, and 10,000 times greater than our birth rank. So how do we evaluate our belief or credence of which hypothesis is more likely? Well, if we think back to the thought experiment with the numbered balls, we can draw some direct parallels. Imagine that evaluating our own birth rank among all humans who have ever lived is like reaching into one of the two containers and pulling out a ball at random. In this case, the ball, your birth rank, is numbered 100 billion. Now, if we consider hypothesis A, where humanity will only ever have at most 1 trillion humans, the odds of pulling a number between 1 and 100 billion are fairly reasonable. That is to say that you would have a 10%, or 1 in 10 probability, of being amongst the first 100 billion people who have ever lived. What about hypothesis B? While using the same reasoning, there's only a 0.01% or 1 in 10,000 chance of you having been born in this initial tiny sliver of humanity. So does this mean that we should assign a higher credence to hypothesis A? And of course, this type of reasoning would also imply that any hypothesis that posits even fewer humans ought to be more credible. Certainly, any such hypothesis would have to give us an estimate that is at least as large as the current number of all humans that have ever lived. Otherwise, it would not be consistent with reality. But beyond that, the smaller the prediction, the more credible it would seem, given this probabilistic argument. Now let us slow down briefly to let all of this sink in. If this way of estimating the fate of humanity seems unnerving, I would totally agree. This is rather weird.
You know when I'm going to die! I do, yes.
And if this thought experiment is familiar to you, then you have probably heard of the so-called doomsday argument, described by the astrophysicist Brandon Carter in the early 1980s. Using probability this way is certainly a fascinating and intriguing way of estimating something that seems unknowable. But is this a valid use of probability? It seems like there is some unstated underlying assumption that would allow us to treat the human question using the same mathematical machinery as the question about the numbered balls in the two containers. So let us call out this assumption so we can scrutinize it directly. So when we pull a ball out at random from a container with a million balls, we can uncontroversially assign that ball a 1 in a million probability of being whatever number it happens to be. But when we reflect on our own existence and state that I am human number 100 billion, how do we extend this birth rank into the future? This brings us to Nick Bostrom's self-sampling assumption, which states that you should think of yourself as if you were a random observer from a suitable reference class. So what is a suitable reference class? Well, Bostrom describes it as a class consisting of all intelligent observers, including those in the past, present, and future. Under this assumption, often abbreviated as SSA in literature, you should consider yourself to be one random human amongst all humans who ever were or will ever be. When used as a foundation for the doomsday argument, the SSA can be quite vexing.
I do not want to know the date of my death!
But there are situations where the SSA can be an intuitive and uncontroversial guiding principle. For example, consider the following thought experiment called Dungeon, presented in Chapter 4 of Bostrom's book. The world consists of a dungeon that has 100 cells. In each cell there is one prisoner. 90 of the cells are painted blue on the outside, and the other 10 are painted red. Each prisoner is asked to guess whether he is in a blue cell or a red cell, and everyone knows all the rules. You find yourself in one of the cells. What color should you think it is?
What is your favorite color?
Blue! No!
If you assume yourself to be a random prisoner in your reference class of prisoners in the dungeon, then guessing that your cell is painted blue on the outside is a reasonable and highly probable choice. Let's consider another thought experiment, this one conceived by the philosopher John Leslie. Imagine that we choose three humans in the world and gave them each an emerald. It'll probably not surprise you that this thought experiment is called Emeralds. Several centuries later, when the original three emerald recipients are no longer around, we give out 5,000 emeralds to 5,000 humans. Now, all these humans know the general setup of our experiment, but they do not know if they are in the initial century or the later century. That is, when you get an emerald, you don't know if the experiment is just starting and you're one of the first three, or if this is centuries later and you're now one of the 5,000. What if you had to make a bet on which phase of the experiment you were part of? What would be a sensible betting strategy?
Baby needs a new pair of shoes!
Leslie tells us this. Suppose you in fact betted that you lived in the earlier century. If every emerald getter in the experiment betted this way, there would be 5,000 losers and only 3 winners. The sensible bet, therefore, is that yours is instead the later century of the two. This seems reasonable and again plays nicely with the self-sampling assumption. In this case, your reference class is the 5,003 people who have been given or will have been given an emerald, and you can think of yourself as a random observer from this class. In which case, there is a much higher probability that you're one of the 5,000 than that you are from the first three. Doesn't seem very controversial, right? And note how the reference class for this problem includes past, current, and future humans. Now, let's flip it around and look at another counterintuitive result. This thought experiment involves the biblical Adam and Eve, and it's called Lazy Adam. You gotta love those philosophers and their Gedanken experiments. Here we go. Adam and Eve were once the only people, and they know for certain that if they have a child, they will be driven out of Eden and will have billions and billions of descendants. But this time, they have a foolproof way of generating a child, perhaps using advanced in vitro fertilization. Adam is tired of getting up every morning to go hunting. Together with Eve, he devises the following scheme. They form the firm intention that unless a wounded deer limps by their cave, they will have a child. Adam can then put his feet up and rationally expect with near certainty that a wounded deer, an easy target for his spear, will soon stroll by. So again, this is kind of a head-scratcher. Using the self-sampling assumption, you would conclude that the probability of you being the first and only two people is much higher than the probability of you being the first two from billions and billions. So, by merely forming the intention to make a baby only if an easy meal doesn't happen to show up, does this somehow anomalously cause the wounded deer to walk by? Much like the doomsday example, the SSA leads us down a path where the conclusions feel unsatisfying and highly counterintuitive. So, what do these same philosophers offer us in the way of alternatives? Well, Bostrom also presents SIA, or the self-indicating assumption, which states that you should, other things being equal, favor hypotheses according to which many observers exist over hypotheses in which few observers exist. This provides a way out of the uncomfortable implications of the doomsday argument, but it has its own shortfalls. You can check out Bostrom's book. The link to an online version is available in the transcript of this episode. The book goes into many similar thought experiments. And yes, most of them will leave you in this weird state where the math says one thing, but your gut intuition says the opposite. Fun stuff, right?
Or does that confuse you?
Now let's get back again to heavenly matters. Hopefully by now we've demonstrated that reasoning about probabilities gets much trickier once you start thinking of your own role as an observer of some experiment. And we also discussed how we must take observational effects into account when doing science. So what do you do if your field is the study of physics and cosmology? The aforementioned astrophysicist Brandon Carter presented his anthropic principle as an expression of such observer-dependent effects. Carter gave two versions of this principle, one weak and one strong. The weak principle states that we should take account of the fact that our location in the universe is necessarily privileged to the extent of being compatible with our existence as observers. So let's unpack that real quick. What Carter is saying is that if you are a person, or alien, or whoever, and you're studying the laws of physics, you should not be surprised when your observations and experiments tell you that your universe indeed has features that make it possible to give rise to life, and in turn observers like yourself. So the fact that you are an observer, again, not necessarily a human observer, and you're out there asking questions about the universe, implies that the universe has the necessary conditions for observers to arise within it. Does it feel like this principle is a tautology? Many folks certainly feel this way. But can the principle be a tautology, but still be used as a motivator for new scientific discoveries? Maybe. One scientific insight that is often credited with anthropic reasoning is Fred Hoyle's 1953 prediction of a resonance state of carbon-12 that had not yet been observed at the time. Hoyle argued that this state of the carbon-12 nucleus had to exist in order to explain how carbon is produced in stars via nucleosynthesis. We know that without this property, stars would not produce sufficient carbon, and hence there would be no carbon-based life. Later experiments confirmed the existence of this state.
The very matter that makes us up was generated long ago and far away in red giant stars.
Whether Hoyle had actually used anthropic-style reasoning in making this prediction is a matter of some debate. For example, Helge Krah, a historian of science, argues that there is no direct historical evidence of Hoyle approaching the problem from an anthropic angle. Hoyle was motivated by the abundance of carbon in the universe, which required an explanation. Krah believes that anthropic reasoning was an after-the-fact attribution to this discovery, and that this connection was made only after the anthropic principle was described in literature and gained mind share in the 1980s. A link to Krog's paper is available in the transcript. I can see how it's tempting to connect the dots, though. I am a biological observer. All life that I know of is carbon-based. The universe appears to have a large amount of carbon in it. It must be the case that physical laws in some way favor carbon production. If this is indeed the chain of thought that leads you to the same prediction as Hoyle, then you can give the anthropic principle credit. Even as a tautology, it can point you in interesting and productive directions. What about the strong anthropic principle? Well, the strong version of the principle states that the universe must be such as to admit the creation of observers within it at some stage. Well, what does that mean? Well, it can be taken to mean that there is something like a purpose that at some point somewhere in the universe observers must come into existence. As you can imagine, this version of the principle is more controversial. Either you interpret it as we are here, therefore the universe must have us, which sounds trivial, or you interpret it as something purposeful, like the universe exists so that we may exist. This sounds a bit more like a teleological argument, closer to intelligent design or something along those lines. The formulation was also a bit vague, so you can imagine that philosophers and physicists have had a field day with this one.
Consider the philosophical and metaphysical ramifications.
So where does this all leave us? Well, for me personally, I like these kinds of thought experiments involving observer-dependent effects. They are nice and meta and lead to various weird conclusions that you can either accept or debate. I will mention my favorite such thought experiment shortly to close out the episode. And as for physics and cosmology, well, it would be interesting to know if working scientists actually care about anthropics. Of course, you have to understand and model observational biases into your data collection and analysis, whatever your field of science is. But as for the anthropic principle itself in its various forms, well, I suspect you can be a successful, condensed matter physicist without ever having to appeal to an observer reference class. But if you're working on the problems of fine-tuning and thinking about the values of various physical constants being what they are, then maybe the anthropic principle is at least good food for thought, regardless of whether you actually use it as a guiding principle. One fun area that we did not explore in this episode is how the anthropic principle can motivate a discussion of multiverses. Perhaps we can save this for another time. Finally, I wanted to mention a now well-known problem of the Sleeping Beauty. It was hearing about this problem a while ago that got me interested in anthropic reasoning and all the puzzles that come with it. This thought experiment has the following setup. On Sunday, the participant, named Sleeping Beauty, goes to sleep in our laboratory. As she sleeps, the experimenters toss a fair coin, which will come up heads or tails. On Monday, she wakes up. If the coin had come up heads, the experiment ends that same day. However, if the coin comes up tails, the Sleeping Beauty has her memory wiped and she is put back to sleep. She then wakes up on Tuesday having no memory of having woken up in the lab the previous morning. Every time the Sleeping Beauty wakes up, she is asked a question. The question is, what is your credence that the coin came up heads? What would you say in her place? We can discuss the possible answers in future episodes. Well, that's about it. Happy New Year. Thank you as always for listening. The transcript of this podcast is available at thebeyondpod.com. And if you have any questions or suggestions for discussion topics, you can email me at thebeyondpod@gmail.com. I hope you find yourself in a reference class of thousands of listeners who enjoy meta topics. Thanks again, and goodbye.